1 Kings 19, verses 1 through 15. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, how he had killed the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a message to Elijah, saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also, if I don't make your life like the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." And he was afraid. He got up and fled for his life, and he came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah. He left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a solitary broom tree, and he asked that he might die. "It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my ancestors." And he lay down under the broom tree and fell asleep. Suddenly an angel touched him and said to him, "Get up and eat." He looked, and there at his head was a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. He ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came a second time, touched him, and said, "Get up and eat, otherwise the journey will be too much for you." He got up and ate and drank. And then he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mount of God. At that place he came to a cave, and he spent the night there. And the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he answered, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. For the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away." He said, "Go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." Now there was a great wind, so strong that it was splitting mountains and breaking rocks in pieces before the Lord. But the Lord wasn't in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord wasn't in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, the sound of sheer silence. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And there came a voice to him that said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he answered, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away." And the Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael as king over Aram." Laura is this close friend of ours. She works at a very large metropolitan hospital. And she works in a powerful environment, in an intensive care unit where life and death happen every day. In that sort of situation, you know, a lot of conversations happen among coworkers about hope and sadness, about life after death, and ultimately about God and God's presence in all of these moments. A few weeks ago, we're at breakfast with Laura and asking her about work and her future and her life. And she tells us that she isn't happy at work. It's one of those situations where she's just forcing herself to go in every day, and it turns out that the real issue that she is struggling with is not really the work environment, the patients, or the hours. The real issue for Laura is the relationship that she has with her coworkers. Most of Laura's coworkers, you see, they go to the same church, and they're from what a lot of folks would call a fundamentalist church background, you know, very literal and black and white in their beliefs, very outspoken, and in Laura's experience, very judgmental and harsh. Laura herself isn't all that into religion. She's really respectful and interested, and she's always asking questions about what we believe. But at this point in her life, she's not a churchgoer. She doesn't have much of a background in religion. She believes in God, but she isn't sure about much past that, and that's okay with us. But this is the issue with her coworkers. They are always on the offensive when she is around. They are bent on converting her, on winning her over, on convincing her that their ideas about faith and God are right. Every conversation she has gets turned into a religious debate, one that she has not invited. And furthermore, when these debates and conversations occur, no one really listens to her or to what her ideas are or respects her questions. In fact, usually the conversations lead to rants about politics and social issues that Laura finds hurtful and mean-spirited. So Laura's just running down this list of conversations and ideas with me, and she says rather profoundly, "You know, I've never really been a churchgoer. But listening to them go on every day, it makes me wonder why anybody would be. That's all I've ever heard about. You never hear about the kind of stuff that you believe in or do. It's just frustrating. Why don't you ever hear about the other side of the story? It just seems like most people who go to church are like them." You ever know anybody like Laura? At one point, I'm guessing some of us in this room have been Laura. and pastoral ministry over the years, I've met a lot of people who appreciated the ideas or the welcoming spirit of churches where I may have been serving, but they just couldn't get past all the baggage and judgment that they felt about Christianity. A lot of us are here in this room, if we tell the truth, because we felt the same thing in other places. And the reality is, Laura's right. You don't hear or see much about the other kind of faith. I mean, when was the last time you saw an interview on Larry King or the local news broadcast where a church or religious leader was speaking about compassion or tolerance or mercy for the people? Not very often. If you're like me, when the so-called religious expert or the Christian perspective is invited onto the screen, I cringe and I tense up and I wonder, what are they going to say this time? And these are the sorts of things that, among other reasons, make me proud and thankful to be part of the Disciples of Christ. Part of the mainline tradition with our brothers and sisters in the United Methodist Church and the Presbyterian Church and others that are a part of movement in Christianity that when we're at our best, we try not to contribute to that sort of painful faith experience. Instead, we try, though sometimes failingly, our very hardest to extend mercy and grace to all people, to share with them the powerful love of Jesus that we have found together. That's also why, for a lot of reasons, why I'm frustrated. I'm frustrated because when people think about Jesus, much of the time they think about the people that my friend Laura works with, about judgment and disrespect, about treating people like pieces of meat to be picked over and converted instead of like children of God worthy of love. It's heartbreaking for me to think that for much of the world, that is their image of Jesus. The books of 1 and 2 Kings are a pretty basic history of royal families in ancient Israel. And sometimes we romanticize kings and we forget that God was never really all that crazy about Israel having a king of any kind, but the people wanted them, so they got them. And some of the kings get good reviews from the prophets and theologians who compose the books, and others get bad ones. And in the middle of this long list of kings and accomplishments, there are these stories about the prophet Elijah. Elijah is presented as this sort of picture of the real Israel, the heart of Hebrew faith, the opposite of all the self-important, cocky attitudes of the kings who get all the press that come and go. In particular, he's presented as the witness of the Holy One of Israel, of the Hebrew faith, in contrast with the current king Ahab and his religion. The bottom line here is that Ahab, the king, has tried to convert the people to a faith that encourages selfishness and self-serving attitudes. His way of viewing the world is take what you can get when you can and look out for yourself. He doesn't value the little people in the Hebrew community. He certainly doesn't value the poor or the strangers and travelers from other places that traditionally the Hebrew religion emphasized special care of. Faith for him was about looking out for himself and providing for himself, proving himself right, not the care of others. And when God sees all this mess, God sends Elijah as a minister to speak to the king and all who would listen about the other God, the Hebrew God, the faith that the people had embraced for centuries that calls for love and patience with each other, that calls for fairness and compassion for those that the power players in the world want to throw away. So just prior to what we read, there's this great throwdown between the political worldview of the king and the protecting creator of the Hebrews via Elijah, and Elijah wins. And it's this great victory for the God of Israel. And the angry political folks get mad, and Elijah goes on the run and hides out in a cave. And that is where the story that we just read begins. Do you realize that statistically, the majority of mainline churches fall into the same issues that our disciple churches in Henry County are having? We're not alone here. Most mainline churches are considered, quote, declining. Which just means, as far as attendance and giving goes, our numbers have peaked at some point in our history, and they are slowly or quickly trending downward. At the same time, the kind of churches that my friend Laura's co-workers are part of, they tend to be trending upward, or at least moving less slowly down the hill than we are. Some of them are at their most popular moments ever. And why is that? Well, in part because those churches have worked really hard and learned to get their name out there, to market themselves a little bit, and they've invested money in doing that. I mean, think for a second. I know that no churches in our area are busting at the seams, but what are the churches that are biggest and growing? They tend to be the ones that are a little more conservative, but also the ones that market themselves with websites and signs and events. And these are the ones that motivate themselves usually with the fear of hell and judgment, forcing them to be visible in the community, lest things go bad for everyone else. And this is hard for us in the mainline church because we pride ourselves on not being pushy. We don't want to bother people to go to church. We want to love them and give them a choice. I mean, I've said from the moment I got to know the disciples in our theology that we are what the world is looking for. But we've done a really good job of hiding ourselves from the world. How do we stay true to who we are and at the same time make room for new people in our churches? I mean, what if we were just as motivated by the love of Jesus as others were by the fear of hell? So Elijah's on the lam. He hides in a cave. He's meditative. He's tired. He's ready to give up. In fact, he asks to die. And there are probably some churches asking to die too. He's been faithful. He's worked miracles in God's name. And now he just wants to hang out in the cave and have somebody else do the work. Several big things happen there in the cave. And every time something big happens, there is this assumption that this big thing that is coming through is the power of God at work, that God is going to do something big, but it's not. And finally, God speaks in the silence. And maybe that's a good word for us to hear. Sometimes, you see, when we don't hear anything, when nothing is happening, maybe that's the most powerful way that God lets us know that something is up. And then God finally speaks, and Elijah defends himself. He says, basically, I've been working for you for years. He says it twice. I have been faithful, and I'm so tired, and this is so hard, and I don't have anything left to give. I'm exhausted. And in lots of places in the Hebrew Scriptures, this sort of rant and explanation of frustration is followed by this kind word or blessing from God, but not this time. God totally ignores Elijah's complaint and just gives him a list of risky things to do. God says, basically, yes, I know you're tired, but the work I have for you is so important. I know it's scary, but there's no time for you to sit in a cave and wait for me to do something. I need you to do the risky stuff so that my people will know who I am. And God's word to Elijah is an important word to churches like ours. There are different options for churches like us. Most churches like us are sitting in the cave, and some churches like us are just asking God to let us die. Some are waiting on God to usher something powerful into our story, to bring the wind and the fire to reignite us, to blow people straight through the parking lot and into our doors. But the problem with that is that God is still being silent in those moments for us. The big storms and the fire and the earthquakes that we've all been waiting for to change things, to make people come back, they aren't happening. Instead, God is calling all of us to get out, to get up and get out of the cave. Yes, it's dangerous out there, and yes, it requires us to take risks and make changes and to do a lot of work and to be flexible, and it is not what we are used to. And God may not change, but the way that God uses people like Elijah and us to connect to the world has to change. The love of God that we find here should be enough to motivate us to get out of our cave. In the coming days, we're going to be talking more about how we can make ourselves more visible in our community. This church is a powerful place. Churches like ours, rural churches in America that a lot of people want to write off or forget, they are important and powerful. There isn't a week that I don't leave here marveling at it, who each of you is, at the spirit of love and openness and compassion that exists here. People need churches like ours. We have so much to offer our community, our neighbors, who need to hear about the God of grace and compassion. But they won't find us if we sit in the cave and wait for them to come to us. So search yourself, ask yourself, what changes am I willing to make? What things can we do here to welcome new people into our midst? Would I be willing to change some of my worship traditions? Would I be willing to change the way things look? If it meant seeing new people meet the same grace and compassion of Jesus that you find here, isn't it worth it to you? Or would you rather keep everything as it is and wait in the cave, safe, and hope that the earthquake or the wind or the fire changes things for us? Or just wait and ask to die? God is calling churches like ours to take risks, to get outside the box, to be as motivated by love as others are by fear. And that is scary. And that is the gospel. It is exactly what Jesus did with the church 2,000 years ago. In the coming weeks, you'll be hearing more about our transformation team. That's meeting to learn new ways for our church to connect with the community. They're going to be visiting other places and hearing other stories of transformation and bringing those stories back to us in hopes of helping us learn to be a risk-taking, gospel-living church, a church that represents the God of love and mercy that people like Laura and our community so need to experience. 2 weeks ago, there were 15 children leading in our worship. We had 3 new families worshiping with us, experiencing the warmth and the grace of this place, this special church, mostly because we chose to try something a little new. And we may never become a huge church, and we may never welcome hundreds of people through our doors, but there can be more days like that ahead of us if we're willing to do things in new ways, to consider new options, if we're willing to be motivated not by fear of dying and not to be scared to get outside of the cave, but if we take the risks that God has for us to take. Gather around this table now. Come to this table with a little of this comfort. Come to this table in a spirit of reflection. Ask yourself, this God who gave body and blood to offer me new life, what am I willing to do to share that grace with others? What changes am I willing to make to see in my church and in myself if it means new people finding grace? God is moving. God is at work around us. But we will not find the Holy One in our cave waiting on something big to happen. We will find God when we become motivated enough by the love that we have found to do the dangerous, risky business that we have been called to outside these doors.